For we have, in this unfolding of knowledge, the two terms of the one and the many, as we have the two terms of the finite and the infinite, of that which becomes and of that which does not become but forever is, of that which takes form and of that which does not take form, of spirit and matter, of the supreme superconscient and the nethermost inconscience, in this dualism, and to get away from it, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. The ultimate of our life would then be a drawing away from the lower reality of the becoming to the greater reality of the being, a leap from the ignorance to the knowledge and a rejection of the ignorance, a departure from the many into the one, from the finite into the infinite, from form into the formless, from the life of the material universe into the spirit, from the hold of the inconscient upon us into the superconscient existence. In this solution, there is supposed to be a fixed opposition, an ultimate irreconcilability in each case between the two terms of our being. Or else, if both are a means of the manifestation of the Brahman, the lower is a false or imperfect clue, a means that must fail, a system of values that cannot ultimately satisfy us. Dissatisfied with the confusions of the multiplicity, disdainful of even the highest light and power and joy that it can reveal, we must drive beyond to the absolute one-pointedness and one-standingness in which all self-variation ceases. Unable by the claim of the infinite upon us to dwell forever in the bonds of the finite, or to find their satisfaction and largeness and peace, we have to break all the bonds of individual and universal nature, destroy all values, symbols, images, self-definitions, limitations of the illimitable, and lose all littleness and division in the self that is forever satisfied with its own infinity. Disgusted with forms, disillusioned of their false and transient attractions, wearied and discouraged by their fleeting impermanence and vain round of recurrence, we must escape from the cycles of nature into the formlessness and featurelessness of permanent being. Ashamed of matter and its grossness, impatient of the purposeless stir and trouble of life, tired out by the goalless running of mind, or convinced of the vanity of all its aims and objects, we have to release ourselves into the eternal repose and purity of the spirit. The inconscient is a sleep or a prison, the conscient a round of strivings without ultimate issue or the wanderings of a dream. We must wake into the superconscious, where all darkness of night and half-lights cease in the self-luminous bliss of the eternal. The eternal is our refuge. All the rest are false values, the ignorance and its mazes, a self-bewilderment of the soul in phenomenal nature. Should I stop here? Okay. Yeah. Our conception of the knowledge and the ignorance rejects this negation and the oppositions on which it is founded. It points to a larger, if more difficult, issue of reconciliation. For we see that these apparently opposite terms of one and many, form and the formless, finite and infinite, are not so much opposites as complements of each other, not alternating values of the Brahman, which in its creation perpetually loses oneness to find itself in multiplicity, and unable to discover itself in multiplicity, loses it again to recover oneness, but double and concurrent values which explain each other, not hopelessly incompatible alternatives, but two faces of the one reality which can lead us to it by realization of both together, and not only by testing each separately, even though such separate testing may be a legitimate or even an inevitable step or part of the process of knowledge. Knowledge is no doubt the knowledge of the One, the realization of the Being. Ignorance is a self-oblivion of Being, the experience of separateness in the multiplicity, and a dwelling or circling in the all-understood maze of becomings. But this is cured by the soul in the becoming, growing into knowledge, into awareness of the Being, which becomes in the multiplicity all these existences, and can so become because that truth is already there in its timeless existence. The integral knowledge of Brahman is a consciousness in possession of both together, and the exclusive pursuit of either closes the vision to one side of the truth of the omnipresent reality. The possession of the Being, who is beyond all becomings, brings to us freedom from the bonds of attachment and ignorance in the cosmic existence, and brings by that freedom a free possession of the becoming and of the cosmic existence. The knowledge of the becoming is a part of knowledge. It acts as an ignorance only because we dwell imprisoned in it. Avidyayam antare, without possessing the oneness of the Being, which is its base, its stuff, its spirit, its cause of manifestation, and without which it could not be possible.
So, here in the first paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is continuing to draw out that distinction between the being and the becoming. But there is a very interesting part in that paragraph that actually points to the element of choice in our journey to the truth. And that part is this, where it says, in fact, the long first sentence itself, "For we have in this unfolding of knowledge the two terms of the one and the many, as we have the two terms of the finite and the infinite, of that which becomes and of that which does not become, but forever is, of that which takes form and of that which does not take form, of spirit and matter, of the supreme superconscient and the nethermost inconscience. In this dualism, and to get away from it, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance."
Excuse me, sorry Debashishji, but you sound really, I can't hear you very well.
Am I coming sort of unclear to most people?
It's just very low.
Oh, actually we can hear you very well, Debashishji. Okay. Very loud also.
Really? Okay, maybe it's something on my end. Okay, I'll investigate.
Okay, So here, this very interesting part is, as he says, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. And it points to the process of the spiritual search for human beings who are mind-embodied beings. And as such, we catch intuitions and experiences of the reality. These experiences of the reality come to us one at a time. And this kind of duality that he's talking about over here is something which... can you hear me? Hello? Can everybody
yes,
hear me?
Yes, very well.
Yes, we can hear you very well.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I see. The reason I'm asking is that I get a message saying Skype cannot hear you talking. But if you can hear me, then that's just in sort of some kind of mistake over here.
I can hear you perfectly as well now.
Okay, good. So, in our human condition, when we are actually having these kind of experiences of reality, this duality presents itself to us as two opposites. And then as he says, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. This reality, this choice is actually a human choice. It's a choice that belongs to the relativism of mind. It is not actually a choice of truth. And this is the reason why, so long as we are mind-embodied beings searching for the spirit, we will always, even in our seekings for spiritual experience and realization, be limited to this kind of a choice which is a combination of spiritual reality and mental reality, a kind of a doubleness over there, and a doubleness which does not give us the fullness of truth. And this is partly the reason why, to understand spirit, one has to rise beyond the mind. And it is only in a certain kind of consciousness, which is beyond the mind, that one can have the root from which truth can be experienced beyond the relativisms. And that's just a point to note about this, and also about the technique or the method Sri Aurobindo follows in the Life Divine, because the method he's following is this method of showing us the various spiritual intuitions and experiences possible to us, and then drawing us towards these experiences or intuitions through the processes of the mind. A process which gives us a certain amount of choice. But at the same time, he's going to point to certain roots. You know, just like the Gita says, the root of the Ashwatha tree is above. The branches are below. So too, the many branches of our darshana philosophies are the mind-embodied approaches towards the spirit, towards the root. It is only in the root that these choices and possibilities are no longer open to us, but are seen as truth. That's one very interesting fact about that particular paragraph, where this duality is laid out by him, and he shows us how, as mind-embodied creatures, we have this kind of proclivity to choose between one or the other. And it seems to be an inevitable choice, but it is actually just a relative choice to choose the one over the many, as if that is the primary truth. And in the second paragraph there, our conception of the knowledge and the ignorance rejects this negation, that is, the negation of the avidya, of the world of the many, and the oppositions on which it is founded. And so he says over here, what he's pointing out is that the one and the many, the being and the becoming, these two worlds, the vidya and the avidya, they are both representations that are simultaneously real. Not one which becomes the other and loses itself in the first. Okay, not alternating values of the Brahman, which in its creation perpetually loses oneness, find itself in multiplicity, and unable to discover itself in multiplicity, loses it again to recover oneness. Now the reason he brings up this issue of alternating experiences is because, again, this is a problem of mental experience. The problem of human beings in the avidya, in the ignorance, is that there is already a split here. The split makes us move into one or the other, see reality as the reality of being and becoming as a secondary reality, or becoming as the primary reality and being as a secondary reality. But he says it is not that one becomes the other and then moves back to the one. There are ancient Greek philosophers like Heraclitus who proposed this kind of an alternation. But as he points out, this is not the case. The actual case is that they are both equal and complementary. They are not so much opposites as complements of each other. Not alternating values, but double and concurrent values which explain each other. Two faces of the one reality which can lead us to it by our realization of both together, and not only by testing each separately. And he has an aside over there: even though such separate testing may be a legitimate or even an inevitable step or part of the process of knowledge. And this is true even in his own case, where the realization of a Advaitic or even a Nirvanic reality came to him first, and then another reality of the what he has called the active Brahman, the becoming, the power behind the becoming, came to him after that. And these two realities seem to coexist as separate realities in his experience or realization. Now this coexistence is something which is possible to us. And that's why he says, instead of alternating or having one at one time and the other at another time, which is more normal to, again, a mental experience of the spiritual, we have to arrive at a certain experience or realization which can hold both these kinds of realities, the reality of being and the reality of becoming, as truths of spirit. Then what we find is that we are actually, you know, realizing something which transcends and includes the two. And that is a status of spirit which Sri Aurobindo calls supermind. In the supramental reality, being and becoming are both seen as concurrent and double realities. And they explain each other. And so the knowledge of the one enters into the ignorance of the many. The many are seen to be many realities, each of them a reality of the one.
Can I ask a question?
Yes,
Shams. So Devashishtha, from the human consciousness, when we are still in the human consciousness and trying to go to that state where it can hold both, when he says it's a legitimate to testing them both one after the other, does he mean that so for a certain period of time you may try to realize one aspect, and then for a certain another period of time you may try to realize another aspect? And during one such period of time, you have completely—it's not possible for us to hold the other aspect in the front of your mind or in the front of your consciousness at all. So it becomes kind of you're jumping from one to the other, maybe for a few days or a few years. Or is that how the process goes?
Yes, Shyam. This may be the process which comes normally to the human consciousness. But at the same time, what he is encouraging is the development of a certain kind of consciousness that can include these at the same time. Now, this is not impossible. This is the point that Sri Aurobindo is making, that our inner consciousness itself, through its own aspiration, can make itself more and more adapted to a transformed consciousness in which multiple aspects of divine realization can coexist. They at first can coexist as separate realities without any unity between them. And this is what happened if you read Sri Aurobindo's own experience. He starts with the Nirvana, but he doesn't get attached to it through his mind. He lives in it. And then he says, into that there entered the experience of the one energy and the one worker in the world. That is what he calls the active Brahman. So the passive Brahman and the active Brahman at that point were two different spiritual realizations that coexisted in his consciousness without necessarily being united or integrated. It is only when a further experience of the immanent divine came to him in the Alipur jail that the integration of the three occurred. And you know, he does encourage, and I think from a certain point of view, this is a characteristic of the integral yoga, that if there is a certain aspiration to hold different aspects or different kinds of consciousness in our own consciousness, that is something which aids in the supramental process or in the supramental yoga. He actually makes a comment even on a very practical level. There is a point where he says, a yogi should be able to do many things at the same time. And this is also something related to this notion of gradually developing a consciousness that becomes multiple, that can hold different kinds of realities at the same time within it.
More of moving towards that.
He didn't hear you.
Yes. In a sense, yes, but as you see in the integral yoga, we are supposed to proceed through all these methods all at once. So to develop the notion of the one consciousness, the knowledge as he calls it, is one aspect of our yoga. But the other aspect is also to develop the notion of that one in the all, in the many. So that notion of the one in the all and in the many, the one in the all, for example, comes very powerfully through the Karma Yoga, where one is trying to make the offering of one's active consciousness and its activities, its works, to the one worker in the world. And as it does that, the realization of the Karma Yoga comes in the form of the identity with the unitary conscious energy, the Shakti, who is the only worker in the world. See, that one realizes there is only one energy at work in all things. See, that is the cosmic energy and the cosmic Shakti. So, in that kind of process, you are actually opening to the one in the all. And then, even to open to the one in the each, to open to the one in the many, is a simultaneous yoga. Just as you are moving towards the one in and by itself. So to recognize the knowledge in as the knowledge of the one in and by itself, like you're saying, is important, and not only important as a prerequisite, but in the integral approach, we don't see this necessarily as the only way to proceed first by achieving that and then by achieving the sense of its existence as the many. But we can proceed simultaneously to through different forms of yoga towards the realization of the one by itself in the all and in the each, in the many. It is difficult to say because these things are so, sort of advanced. But yes, it would seem so because in Sri Ramakrishna's case, exactly in that form, each yoga was taken up one after the other and a realization was had. And, multiple kinds of windows or realities of the divine were experienced by him maybe one after the other, and maybe even to some extent coexisting in his consciousness. So, yes, from that point of view, that does seem to be what Sri Ramakrishna's experience was like.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
Okay. It's actually a very practical question. Okay, let me phrase it properly. Okay, how about now? Okay. I have to almost like touch my microphone. okay. Basically, my question is that it is my personal practical question, is that to some extent I feel that I exist, divine exists, but somehow it is not something that I can really know what exists. I can feel certain effects, like certain sensation, or not really sensation, certain kind of, I probably is delight, which is very concrete. That much, to that extent, at my heights, I can feel. My question is that since Mother keeps talking about that, become conscious at every point, every moment, and from this every cell of your body to everything that you have. So is it that, sometimes I feel that it's my mind which tries to take possession of this consciousness, means mind wants to feel that I will become conscious. Means it tries to analyze or, tries to get into that role of becoming conscious. And I become, I become sort of my mind with that process. And that definitely limits immediately any kind of experience that could come. But I'm just saying, is that a procedure, like how to become detached from that role of the mind of becoming conscious? Because mind is not the instrument, right?
The mind is an instrument. Now, in terms of becoming conscious, one may say that there are various kinds of consciousnesses in us. And so, as you said, the mother said that become conscious in all of your being, from the cells of your body to the highest ranges of consciousness available to you. Over there, what we are being called upon to do is to focus the attention of the consciousness in all these planes or make them all aware of the consciousness that is focused in them. So the mind can play and certainly plays a role, and I think that is what you're talking about in this, which is that the mind can draw attention to this need for consciousness, to this need for the every point of the being to become conscious. And then these points of the being, the vital consciousness, the will, the emotional being, the thoughts, all these can be separate points of attention that the mind as an instrument can draw attention to. So I think in terms of detachment and rising beyond the mind, of course the root of consciousness is there, but that root consciousness, that is the one in the many, the one who transcends everybody and everything, is transcendental, and into which we can merge everything, in a sense, can be seen as unreal from there, including ourselves. But at the same time, that has entered into everything and has figured itself in different forms of consciousness at different levels of the being. So in this approach, the mind has a role to play, because the mind actually, you know, the center of the mental consciousness, the Ajna chakra, the center of the between the eyebrows, is the center of will that draws focus and attention and can actually channel a higher will into our different parts so that they can be drawn, you know, reminded. It's like a reminder that become conscious. That kind of role can be played by it, I feel.
Thank you.
Yes. See, the term avidya over here, as Sri Aurobindo is using it, he's taking it from the Isha Upanishad's use. And avidya, for us, it means ignorance. But ignorance, according to the Isha Upanishad, has a double meaning. It's really the realm of the many, the realm of the multiplicity. Now, the realm of the multiplicity is ignorant of the knowledge, because, or only so long as it does not realize that the one is latent within it, that the one is immanent in it, is inside it, that each one is actually the one. So this knowledge is immanent in the reality of the multiplicity, in the becoming. And in that sense, avidya, as the ignorance or as the separative knowledge, the knowledge of the many, has got the reality of the one latent within it. That is why it is avidyayam antare. Within the avidya is the vidya, so to say.
So, in a way, we are actually defining ignorance as the state in which we are aware only of the multiplicity, right?
Yes, we are defining ignorance as, yes, the state in which we are aware of the multiplicity. You're absolutely right. And so also, as far as the term avidya is concerned, the term avidya is defined as the reality of the multiplicity. And avidya in that sense is not merely ignorance as something which will always remain separate from the truth of the one, but can also be, avidya can also has the potential of realizing itself to be just a form of vidya. That's why at one place earlier he says it's just a degree of knowledge, just as knowledge is, can be seen as a degree of the ignorance.
So we should really see it only as a continuous scale and not as a gulf, one which does not have the requisite knowledge and another which does.
Yeah, we should see it as a scale, but we should also see it as a, transformable reality, not merely as a scale, but because it's the separation from the one that causes us to realize multiplicity as ignorant reality by itself. Multiplicity as a kind of a fragmentation of being. But this fragmentation of being is just a device by which the becoming becomes multiple facets of the one. And so it is transformable in that sense. Ignorance is a knowledge which has lost its own root. And therefore, not only a kind of a continuity, but also a transformable reality.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Debashishda?
Yes.
Can you touch upon that Ashwatha tree again? I couldn't catch the whole image.
I was talking there about that part where Sri Aurobindo is representing the choice of the search for knowledge, where he says that we may represent, or it is open to us to represent the knowledge as belonging to the domain of the one and the ignorance as belonging to the domain of the many, the knowledge to be sought in the one and the many to be therefore rejected. This being open to us is the domain of choice. The domain of choice arises because there is a certain kind of unknowing, because it is within the ignorance that this kind of choice exists. If it was clear to us what the truth is, then how we configure knowledge and ignorance to ourselves would no longer have been a choice. It would have been the truth. So this I was actually comparing to the fact that the Ashwatha tree of the Gita, with its roots above and its branches below, so long as you are in the realm of the branches, they are this tangled reality of many possibilities. But when you can see things from above, that's where the roots are above, not below, then the branches can be explained through those, through that realm and through that consciousness.
Okay. And one more thing, that Maya, as it is used in the Vedanta, it is same thing as avidya, isn't it?
No, Maya is a power. Maya is a shakti. Maya is Brahman's power of presenting itself as the many. How does the one become the many? Or how does the one even divide itself? How does that which is beyond division become divided? That possibility is the operation of Maya.
And this is a little different from what the Advaitins talk about, no? That as in the Maya, as in the Buddhism?
Yeah, Mayavadin philosophies, as they are called. And both Advaita and Buddhism are seen as Mayavadin philosophies. They are talking about Maya also as a power of projection, but they firstly don't see its origin in the Brahman. They see it as a mysterious power whose origin cannot be explained, but that produces illusions, that produces unrealities. And, you know, this part that we are reading, if we move on to just the very next part, he's going to start moving into those aspects of, you know, right. So far he has been talking about the Advaitic Advaitic division of reality into the one and the many, and the rejection of the many in the favor of the one. But that is a prioritization of being over becoming, you may say. But from the next, as we continue, we'll find that he introduces the Buddhist strain, where there is a becoming without a being, as it were. And so that is the role of Maya. There is a little different, though again it is a projection of some power that creates illusions, where did this power come from? It is not a power that happens within the Brahman, but it is a power that happens out of the inconscience. And in some sense, from that point of view, Buddhism is a materialism. It is much closer to the philosophy of science than, say, older Indian spiritualities or the other philosophy of Advaita. I think that part will become very, very much more developed if we continue into the next paragraph, etc.
In fact, the Brahman is one not only in a featureless oneness beyond all relation, but in the very multiplicity of the cosmic existence. Aware of the works of the dividing mind, but not itself limited by it, it finds its oneness as easily in the many, in relations, in becoming, as in any withdrawal from the many, from relations, from becoming. Ourselves also, to possess even its oneness fully, must possess it. Since it is there, since all is that, in the infinite self-variation of the cosmos, the infinity of the multiplicity finds itself explained and justified only when it is contained and possessed in the infinity of the One. But also, the infinity of the One pours itself out and possesses itself in the infinity of the many. To be capable of that outpouring of its energies, as well as not to lose itself in it, not to recoil, defeated from its boundlessness and endlessness of vicissitudes and differences, as well as not to be self-divided by its variations, is the divine strength of the free Purusha, the conscious soul in its possession of its own immortal self-knowledge. The finite self-variations of the self, in which the mind, losing self-knowledge, is caught and dispersed among the variations, are yet not their denials, but the endless expression of the infinite, and have no other meaning or reason for existence. The infinite too, while it possesses its delight of limitless being, finds also the joy of that very limitlessness in its infinite self-definition in the universe. The divine being is not incapable of taking innumerable forms, because he is beyond all form in his essence. Nor by assuming them does he lose his divinity, but pours out rather in them the delight of his being and the glories of his Godhead. This gold does not cease to be gold because it shapes itself into all kinds of ornaments and coins itself into many currencies and values. Nor does the earth power, principle of all this figured material existence, lose her immutable divinity because she forms herself into habitable worlds, throws herself out in the hills and hollows, and allows herself to be shaped into utensils of the hearth and household, or as hard metal into the weapon and the engine. Matter, substance itself, subtle or dense, mental or material, is form and body of spirit, and would never have been created if it could not be made a basis for the self-expression of the spirit. The apparent inconscience of the material universe holds in itself darkly all that is eternally self-revealed in the luminous superconscient. To reveal it in time is the slow and deliberate delight of nature and the aim of her cycles. Shall we read one more? Hey, no one. Anyone there?
Oh, sorry. I had started talking, but my microphone was muted.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so I was saying that in this wonderful paragraph, I think it's better we stop here for a little bit, because from the next paragraph, the idea changes. So in this paragraph, he rounds up the thought that has gone before. And this is really a very glorious presentation of Sri Aurobindo's vision, and unites or gives the integral view of the one and the many, as well as of spirit and matter. It hinges on the fact that the one is infinite. We are talking of the infinite one. And so if the one is infinite, then the one realizes its own infinity by becoming infinite realities that are at the same time the one. So it is this duality, the one evolving its own infinity, and the infinite evolving their oneness, which is the double action, you may say. And there's one place which Sri Aurobindo calls it the double evolution. In fact, there is one place where he's looking at spirit and matter as two realities that are evolving simultaneously their infinite potencies into each other. Spirit is evolving into matter, and matter is evolving into spirit. And that is, in a sense, how he's expressing it towards the end also. He talks about these two realities being mirror realities, realities that are the same in represented form and for the purpose of a development and a delight of self-possession. Right at the end where he says, the apparent inconscience of the material universe holds in itself darkly all that is eternally self-revealed in the luminous superconscient. To reveal it in time is the slow and deliberate delight of nature and the aim of her cycles.
So, Devashista, in this paragraph, it's more of him outlining his vision than him developing an argument over a series of steps, correct?
Well, he has already developed the argument in the last two paragraphs. And over here, he is actually rounding it up. And of course, it is his vision, but at the same time, it is the rounding up of the argument that has gone before.
Sure, thank you.
And whenever he rounds up, he becomes very poetic, right?
Yes, this is very true. This happens also in Savitri. It's particularly the passages where everything rises to a great height of integrality, and he is giving us, as it were, in his own voice. These are the places where Sri Aurobindo's own voice is very apparent to us. It is the voice of the supramental Purusha.
Yeah, somehow it touches within much more than when he's actually being very mental and trying to develop an argument.
Yes.
Actually, with this kind of paragraphs, I feel the whole life divine is like a philosophical poem.
Yes, it is so true. It is a philosophical poem. It is where the boundaries between poetry and philosophy thin and disappear. Shall we move on to the next paragraph, Sita?
Yeah, someone can read. Shyam, you want to read? Okay. Okay, so Shyam can.
But there are other conceptions of reality, other conceptions of the nature of knowledge which demand consideration. There is the view that all that exists is a subjective creation of mind, a structure of consciousness, and that the idea of an objective reality, self-existent, independent of consciousness, is an illusion, since we have and can have no evidence of any such independent self-existence of things. This way of seeing may lead to the affirmation of the creative consciousness as the sole reality, or to the denial of all existence and the affirmation of non-existence, or a Nisian zero as the sole reality. For, in one view, the objects constructed by consciousness have no intrinsic reality. They are merely structures. Even the consciousness that constructs themselves, that constructs them, is itself only a flux of perceptions that assume an appearance of connection and continuity and create a sense of continuous time. But in reality, these things have no stable basis, as they are only an appearance of reality. This would mean that the reality is an eternal absence at once of all self-conscious existence and of all that constitutes movement of existence. Knowledge would mean a return to that from the appearance of the constructed universe. There would be a double and complete self-extinction, the disappearance of Purusha, the cessation or extinction of Prakriti. For the conscious soul and nature are the two terms of our being, and comprehend all that we mean by existence and the negation of both is the absolute nirvana. What is real then must be either an inconscience in which these flux and these structures appear, or a superconscience beyond all idea of self or existence. But this view of the universe is only true of the appearance of things when we regard our surface mind as the whole of consciousness. As a description of the working of them, of that mind, it is valid. There, undoubtedly, all looks like a flux and a construction by an impermanent consciousness. But this cannot prevail as a whole account of existence if there is a greater and deeper self-knowledge and world knowledge, a knowledge by identity, a consciousness to which that knowledge is normal, and a being of which that consciousness is the eternal self-awareness. For then, the subjective and the objective can be real and intimate to that consciousness and being. Both can be something of itself, sides of its identity, authentic to its existence.
So here, Sri Aurobindo, in the previous paragraph and the previous set of paragraphs, has, we may say, exhausted the Advaitic view. He has taken it up and he has gone beyond it. He has shown another way of understanding the duality of the one and the many. But now he is saying this is not the only way in which reality can be conceived. Again, it's again the whole notion of what it is open to us to conceive. Again, this is the problem of the mind in the ignorance. That even spiritual reality, spiritual experience and intuition can be rendered in certain terms which are conceptions or conceptual. And this is another conceptual reality, as he points out over here. And this reality brings us into Buddhism and also into certain other kinds of philosophies, as the next paragraphs will show. But it also brings us into more modern kinds of Western philosophies, like the philosophies of science, of materialism. Because here, as he's pointing out, that if we were to start with the assumption that consciousness is what gives us whatever description of reality we have, this consciousness, that whatever we describe to ourselves as the world, is really a product of human consciousness. Here he uses consciousness with a capital C, but as he will point out later, it is only the surface consciousness of the human being, of the human mind, that looks upon this universe and addresses it and describes it to itself. Therefore, if this consciousness was not there, perhaps this world would not be there. Now, what would be there then? That becomes the big question. Is consciousness rooted in something real? Is it rooted in something permanent? And Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here that if we look at human consciousness as a kind of product, an accidental product of either an inconscience or a superconscience, consider it as an accidental product of inconscience, and there you have materialism, that matter somehow has produced this thing called mind, which is an accident, and that this mind, looking at what it calls a world, describes itself, this world, to itself and to others that have mind. But this may have no reality to whatever this so-called mind consciousness is rooted in. Moreover, mind consciousness itself is a temporary formation or structure of this inconscience whose properties completely elude us, whose properties we configure or represent to ourselves only in terms of the limited understandings and figures of the mind. So if that is the case, then both the world that we describe to ourselves due to the property of mental consciousness and mental consciousness itself that does this describing are impermanent and unreal. And therefore, both are to be negated. And that's why he says over there, there would be a double and complete self-extinction, the disappearance of Purusha, the cessation or extinction of Prakriti. For the conscious soul and nature are the two terms of our being. Subject and object are both structures of impermanence. Cessation of our being and comprehend all that we mean by existence, and the negation of both is the absolute nirvana. See, this is from a certain point of view the Buddhist angle on things, that there is something that we can call inconscience or matter, but what it is we will never know. Whatever it is that we are calling matter is the description that our mental consciousness is giving us. Matter has a reality because out of that reality this consciousness has sprung. That consciousness is rooted in something, but that thing, whatever it is, we'll never know. What we can know are structures of description that the mind can give us. The mind itself is a structure of description that this, you know, sort of incomprehensible thing has projected. How has it projected it? Through the power of Maya. This is again what we were discussing earlier. This is another take on Maya. Maya is an inscrutable producer of illusions and accidents that has created this thing called consciousness, which itself then creates a thing called world. Both need to be negated, and then we can disappear into that which, or disappear into the void, into the nothingness.
So Devashish, two questions here. So you said that so this is in a way a Buddhist view of things.
A Buddhist and also a materialist.
The first question is, so in Buddhism and or even in materialism, do they answer the what, do they try to go into what the source of the Maya itself is?
No, they don't answer what the source of the Maya is. They don't have any answer to that. And there are many different Buddhist schools that arise as a result of this, sort of gray area.
And the other question was about, you said that it's in a way a materialist view of things as well. So there, in modern science or materialism, even there, do they question that the world itself is not real and it's only a construction of the mind? I mean, it's not something that I have come across a lot. Is that something that in the materialist view that is conceived, that it's all only, it may be only a construction of the mind and not really anything anything material?
There is a very old debate about this in science, and this debate is also very active in circles having to do with quantum physics, etc. But actually, it is not today's debate. It begins at the very beginning of the Enlightenment, because even with people like Kant, they're actually saying that you can never know reality as it is. So from the point of view of science, there are two major schools that emerge. One is that matter has an absolute reality, and we have a way, we have some hold, mind has some way of describing this reality, because ultimately this reality, the material reality, is ordered and mental. In other words, the very search for absolute laws in matter means that mind is latent or immanent in matter, and we possess mind. So we will arrive at the real properties of matter someday. This is one angle of view of science. The other is, we will never arrive at any true understanding of matter, because whatever we call matter is actually conditioned by our minds. So it is only a mental construct that we are arriving at, and we can only say that there is a certain kind of concordance between different perceptions of reality, and that is all that science is interested in. Inspiration of what? No, not that.
So the Vashishta, so between these schools itself, there is no, I think it seems that at least from the level of the mind, it seems impossible to reconcile. So they just coexist with each other.
Yes. Hello? Can you hear me?
We can't hear.
Hello, can you hear me now? Oh. Yes, sorry.
Is anybody there?
Yes, we I was hear. Muted.
Why?
No, we can't hear anyone, right?
Get me, Rappa.
I can hear everyone also. Okay, now we can hear.
Yeah.
Okay, so, there is an echo. Hello? Okay. Still there is an echo coming. Okay, no, I was saying that regarding Shyam's question about, was that Sita's question about where mind comes from? The issue of where mind comes from, just as the other issue of where Maya comes from,
is thought to be a question not worth asking, because, you know, just like the question of teleology, in other words, what is the purpose of this universe, is thought of as a question not worth asking in Advaita. Okay, if you ask this question, but what is the purpose of the universe, they'll say there are certain questions that don't have any meaning to reality. So this is one of them. So similarly, the question, where does mind arise from, is a question which doesn't have any reality to science, because it considers it to be what it calls an accident, an epiphenomenon of matter, of biochemistry. And then regarding what Shyam was saying, do they just coexist? Yes, they coexist, but you see, the thing is that they also become approaches to truth. Each one of them is an approach to truth in its own way. The Buddhist approach to truth is an approach to a spiritual truth. And it leads to a spiritual result. It leads to a spiritual realization. And that's the point that Sri Aurobindo is making to some extent, even with the previous paragraphs, that each one of these is a certain standpoint that can have a reality, and that, followed by the mind with a certain discipline, can yield a certain spiritual truth. And because it yields a spiritual truth, there is a justification in saying that this is true, this is real. But again, it's the whole issue of the Ashwatha tree with its roots above and its branches below. Each branch will give you one aspect of reality, but it cannot give us the integral reality. To know that, one has to be in the integral being, in the integral truth.
Hello?
Yes.
Actually, is it possible to say that some similarity exists between Buddhism and, it's just, I'm thinking it as a possibility, that and materialism, is that both deny to accept any existence of a concrete thing, any concreteness, like, it's basically materialism is saying that, you know, we are describing the phenomenon, but that's all, that's it. Not something absolute behind the phenomenon, but we are describing the exchange of, our interactions in within the phenomenon, phenomenal universe. And Buddhism is saying that ultimately there is nothing. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that the similarity lies in the fact that both denies any concreteness.
Yes, that's exactly it. Both of them denies any access to anything concrete. Now, whether there is anything concrete or not, they both sort of take an agnostic viewpoint on that. That is there something called matter beyond any kind of limitation of properties that we can ascribe to it? That is a question that both of them will take an agnostic viewpoint on. But from the viewpoint of the human being, there is no access to any concrete reality, exactly as you put it. That is the similarity.
I have another question, Devashisa.
Yes.
Yes.
When he is talking in this chapter of these various views, like he spoke of the various Advaitic views, and now he's speaking of the Buddhist, like what may be taken as the Buddhist or the materialist view, the tendency in the mind is there to create a hierarchy, as this knowledge X is greater than another knowledge Y, or something else is an even more truer reality than another. So to curb this tendency, is that to be done by some kind of a reinforcement in the mind that is not to be done? Or what is the mechanism by which it can hold all of them together without trying to create that a kind of hierarchy in the mind of one knowledge being greater or kind of better than another.
Yes, it's exactly as you said it. I mean, the natural tendency of the mind is to make assertions which automatically prioritize one aspect of reality over another. And the only way out of that is to create formulations in which we see things dialectically. In other words, see things as composites, as complementary, as things that coexist, opposites that coexist, and not only coexist, that turn into one another, that are productive in that sense, by relating to each other, by one becoming the face of the other, and representing different dimensions of an infinite reality. See, in this, and he actually points the way to us himself, because as you'll see in this particular case, he brings up each of these notions or conceptions of reality and then enlarges these very notions into an integral view. And he'll do the same over here. He'll point out how he ends that paragraph. As he points out that so long as we are constrained by a limited human surface mental consciousness, we can make conclusions of this kind. But if a certain experience is available to us, which transcends the duality of the perceptions of the world as well as of the perceiver of the world, if we can arrive at an experience in which these are seem to be self-representations of an identity, then naturally this kind of, you know, conception falls apart. And in saying that, he's basically pointing out that, you know, it's really experience that decides in the ultimate analysis which of these conceptions are true and which are not. That's why look at the end. He talks about that whole conception of viewpoint, and then he says, but this cannot prevail as a whole account of existence if there is a greater and deeper self-knowledge and world knowledge, a knowledge by identity, a consciousness to which that knowledge is normal, and a being of which that consciousness is the eternal self-awareness. For then the subjective and the objective can be real and intimate to that consciousness and being. Both can be something of itself, sides of its identity, authentic to its existence.
So in a way it seems that I read it as him acknowledging or affirming this truth as long as you are still living in a mental consciousness. And that in a way only when you get out of that are you going to be able to see them as multiple sides of the same reality, and that until then it is a valid experience for you.
Yes, it is a valid experience, but if we are to take that as the ultimate and final experience, then we will land ourselves in a problem. We land ourselves in a maze, as he says over there. As a description of the working of that mind, it is valid. There, undoubtedly, all looks like a flux and a construction by an impermanent consciousness. So long as we are there, it's fine. But what he's telling us is that we have to measure our own experience of reality against the possibility of other experience. And, you know, this is again, in terms of epistemology, in terms of how we arrive at knowledge, you know, the whole Vedantic knowledge, you know, that there's a chapter in this very book called Methods of Vedantic Knowledge,
In methods of Vedantic knowledge, he is pointing out that we have to open our own forms of knowledge to other forms of knowledge greater than ours. So if this is what the surface mentality is capable of, true, this is valid to us as the as a description of the working of reality. But at the same time, if somebody else is coming along and saying that no, there is a deeper self-knowledge and a deeper world knowledge, a knowledge by identity in which subject and object are seen as representations of the self, then we need to be open to that. Because indeed, that will actually give credence to this particular view and supersede it. See?
Yeah, so it's really kind of an invitation to ask ourselves to expand ourselves.
Yes, exactly. I mean, what he's saying is, it's not necessary to be restricted to this viewpoint as the only valid one, if it is possible to have this kind of other experience. So can we aim for that and see whether it is possible or not? In aiming for that, we look for those who may have found that, and we try to at least investigate it. Investigate it in consciousness through yoga. And that leads us to the realization of that.
Yeah, beautiful.
Start from on the other hand. Right? I'm saying it should start from that on the other hand, right? Yeah. On the other hand, if the constructing mind or consciousness is real and the soul reality, then the universe of material beings and objects may have an existence, but it is purely subjective structural, made by consciousness out of itself, maintained by it, dissolving into it in their disappearance. For if there is nothing else, no essential existence or being supporting the creative power, and there is not either a sustaining void or nihil, then this consciousness which creates everything must itself have or be an existence or a substance. If it can make structures, they must be constructions out of its own substance or forms, or forms of its own existence. A consciousness which is not that of an existence, or is not itself an existence, must be an unreality, a perceptive force of a void, or in a void raising their unreal structures made of nothing. A proposition which is not easily acceptable unless all others prove to be invalid. It then becomes apparent that what we see as consciousness must be a being or an existence out of whose substance of consciousness all is created.
Actually, can I ask a question, Devashishtha, before we continue?
Okay.
So when you say existence, Is that something that can be explained in terms of other terms, or is it a kind of a primitive that exist is a word that cannot be further broken down?
Yes. It is primitive in that sense. So it is primordial in that sense. It is the base or the basis of all other terms of reality. You may say reality ultimately, you know, has to rest on something, and that is existence. So there is something even more primordial, which is the unmanifest infinite, beyond being and non-being. But to talk of existence in terms of other things is also possible, and that's exactly what he's doing here. He's trying to see other ways of conceiving of reality, which have in some sense tried to prioritize other terms and make existence secondary, or even make existence unreal. Okay, existence is made unreal in Buddhism, for example, because existence is something which itself is a property of consciousness there, and consciousness itself is something which is an impermanent accident which can be wiped out. Right? So he's looking at these philosophies which make this so-called primordial thing called existence into something secondary, into no, or something unreal. And the first one was that issue. Well, even he starts with Advaita there. In Advaita, we can say existence is primary, primordial, and exclusive. There is nothing other than it. Okay. In Buddhism, we can say existence is unreal. Okay, and non-existent. It doesn't. There is no such thing as existence. In this notion that he's coming up with now, the paragraph just read, he's talking about the becoming, or the creative power, the conscious power, as primary, and existence as secondary, or not having any primordial reality. This is the view that he's taking up here. And there are philosophers and philosophies that have taken that view. For example, even Shaktism, to some extent, is like this. The Shaktism does not deny the reality of conscious existence, or existence as the ground of becoming. Now, it talks about, again, being and becoming as complementary, as polarities that are representing the infinite reality in a kind of inextricable and inseparable way. But there are other philosophies, particularly Western philosophies of this kind. And in fact, there are number of modern philosophies which are of this kind. For example, the philosophy of Nietzsche, or the philosophy of Whitehead. Now, Whitehead thinks, for example, that there is a creative power, and where he introduces a new element into materialism is that he is proposing that there is a creative principle that is more primordial than matter. That, if you want to call the beginning of the material universe the Big Bang, already involved in the Big Bang is this so-called creative principle. That it has a certain kind of power of creativity that is bodying forth a variety of manifestations. And these manifestations are manifestations of creativity, which in the human being becomes self-conscious. In Nietzsche, again, it is similar. He does not believe in a being which pre-exists the becoming.
So according to him, there is a primordial becoming. And human being is a aspect of that becoming. And again, in his case, there is a creative power implicit in becoming. Human being is an aspect of that becoming or a stage of that becoming in which that creative power has become conscious so that human being can actually employ creativity not merely to create products which we call art or literature or whatever other human products of creativity, but to recreate himself. In other words, human being can exceed the human. Human being is the principle of primordial principle of creativity, become conscious in such a way or to such a degree that he can exceed himself, and that is the Superman. That's how, in a sense, Sri Aurobindo's notion of Superman is prefigured in Nietzsche. It's that same power of becoming. But he does not believe that there is an archetype, one may say, of the supermind, even in the superconscience, that is latent in the becoming. That, in a sense, that there is a being which is infinite, infinite being whose infinite potency is the becoming. See, that he does not see. So in a sense, Sri Aurobindo is drawing attention to these kinds of philosophies which prioritize or make primordial the becoming and see this power of becoming as something which does not need existence or being to background it. It is infinite in itself. Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here, it has to have some basis. If we are talking about a power of becoming, an infinite power of becoming, a creative power, which is creating structures, then it must have or itself be a substance. And if it is or has substance, then that substance can, in its essential reality, be nothing other than being. So becoming, unless it is something which is based in nothingness, is a certain formulation of being. Particularly if we talk about an infinite power of becoming, it cannot but be a mobile aspect of infinite being. And that's the argument he's making there. And then he's talking about, if it is backgrounded by the void, for example, if we take that to be a concept of reality, a consciousness which is not that of an existence or is not itself an existence must be an unreality. A perceptive force of a void or in a void raising their unreal structures made of nothing. A proposition which is not easily acceptable unless all others prove to be invalid. It is an extremely improbable proposition, is the point that he's making over there. And we have to first prove that more probable things are invalid before we can go there. It's very interesting, as I was saying, this entire this chapter and a lot of the Life Divine proceeds from this viewpoint of mental possibilities, but it is actually shedding light from a realm beyond the mind. It is giving mind its play, but at the same time pointing out to it its various possibilities as seen from a reality beyond them, as they can be corrected or as they can be superseded by a integral reality.
So it's in a way telling the mind that, hey, you may have thought of this or this or this, and this is where you would go if you took each of these to its logical conclusion.
Yes.
So, in some ways, this question of being or becoming, which is more primordial, becomes in the very basis at which the starting point at which the different philosophies branch out in different directions. And once you take a stand on one of them, then you can go to infinite distance on that basis alone while completely forgetting the other.
Yes, yes, this is how various philosophies have branched out. And what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here is that infinite reality, by dint of its being infinite, accommodates all these views, all these conceptions, and goes beyond all of them. Infinite reality is something which goes beyond knowledge and ignorance. It is something which, in that sense, is beyond being and non-being, beyond existence and non-existence, beyond being, becoming, being and becoming, but also beyond being and non-being. So, over here, what we see is that he points out how each of these terms ultimately is backgrounded by a certain type of conscious being, which itself is a representation of that which is beyond being. Infinite to itself, but represented to itself for the sake of self-knowledge.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is that how is it, I mean, someone can think that, okay, it's the way we perceive the reality is not what there is. But how can you conclude that there is nothing? I mean, it's just, I mean, to me, it seems pretty impossible to perceive that. I mean, I can say, okay, it's not known to me, or the way I see it, it's not the way it is. What I'm trying to say is that the conclusion of nothingness, how is that possible? I mean, unknowable is one thing and nothing is another thing, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Actually, the Buddhist viewpoint does not conclude that there is nothing. The Buddhist viewpoint concludes that it is not possible for us to know if there is something or not. And in this one that Sri Aurobindo is talking about over here, a consciousness which is not that of an existence, etc., raising their unreal structures made of nothing, a proposition which is not easily acceptable unless all others prove to be invalid. So that is it. The only way that we can actually arrive at the fact that there is nothing at the base of things is if we can actually prove that there is, that all other, that not only that we cannot know whether there is something, that we, but we can know that there is, all other possibilities are not real or not true. So, you know, that there is nothing is, as you are saying, not open to us to as mental beings to arrive at. Both Buddhism and science, from that point of view, do not pass any judgment on whether there is some or is not some ultimate thing or basis of consciousness or existence. Only that it can never be known, because whatever we call consciousness, which knows or which gives descriptions of reality, is itself conditioned. Reality that we are giving descriptions of is a conditioned description, and consciousness which is giving those descriptions is a conditioned consciousness. So we can erase both of them, and having erased both of them, subjectivity and objectivity disappears for us. But whether something else remains beyond that is something that they want, that doesn't have any meaning. It ceases to have meaning.
Okay, one more question I had, that the being, is there a definition of a being without a becoming other than manifest?
definition of being without a becoming other than the unmanifest. Unless we are to take the becoming as an illusion, as a kind of epiphenomenon of being. It's not really there, but it seems to be. So the becoming is not reality, is not a reality, but an illusion. If that can be thought of, then you can say that there can be a being without a becoming other than the unmanifest. But otherwise, yes, and that also is like a quibbling with terms. Because if there is some kind of a becoming, even if we call it an illusion, it is only being called an illusion. It can also be called a becoming.
So what you're saying is calling something illusion or becoming is just a choice of words rather than the word illusion, which has different connotations in common language.
Yes, exactly. It's a choice of the mind, because just as he says, that's how we began our reading today. As he says over there, in this dualism and to get away from it, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. This being open to us, it's just a standpoint of the mind. Yes.
Yeah, sure. okay. Which paragraph is it?
But.
Okay. Okay. Okay, but if we thus get back to the Bayun, or the dual reality of being and consciousness, we can either suppose with Vedanta one original being, or with Sankhya, a plurality of beings, to whom consciousness or some energy to which we attribute consciousness presents its structures. If a plurality of separate original beings alone is real, then since each would be or create its own world in its own consciousness, the difficulty is to account for their relations in a single identical universe. There must be a one consciousness or one energy corresponding to the Sankhya idea of a single Prakriti, which is the field of experience of many like Purushas, in which they meet in an identical mind-constructed universe. This theory of things has the advantage of accounting for the multitude of souls and multitude of things and the oneness in diversity of their experience, while at the same time it gives a reality to the separate spiritual growth and destiny of the individual being. But if we can suppose a one consciousness or a one energy creating a multitude of figures of itself and accommodating in its world a plurality of beings, there is no difficulty in supposing a one original being who supports or expresses himself in a plurality of beings, souls or spiritual powers of his one existence. It follows also that all objects or the figures of consciousness would be figures of the being. It must then be asked whether this plurality and these figures are realities of the one real existence, or representative personalities and images only, or symbols or values created by mind to represent it. This would depend largely on whether it is only mind as we know it that is in action, or a deeper and greater consciousness, of which mind is a surface instrument, executrix of its initiations, medium of its manifestations. If it is the former, the universe constructed and seen by mind can only have a subjective or symbolic or representative reality. If the latter, then the universe and its natural beings and objects can be true realities of the one existence, forms or powers of its being manifested by its force of being. Mind would be only an interpreter between the universal reality and the manifestations of its creative consciousness force, Shakti Prakriti Maya.
Can I ask a quick question about Sankhya?
Okay.
So, Devashishta, in Sankhya, the single Prakriti and the many Purushas, do they say what the source of the many Purushas and this Prakriti is, or are they just existent by themselves?
They are existent by themselves. In the original Sankhya, and I think we can take this up in greater detail next time, but Sankhya looks at reality as a duality with one Prakriti and many Purushas, and they are originally primordial, just like we were talking about existence. Both these are primordial realities that coexist without any prior cause.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Devashishta. We can definitely take it up more next time.
Okay. Yeah, we are reading the chapter on Essays on the Gita where he talks about Sankhya.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm. The Gita reconfigures some of these ideas.
Yeah.
So, Sita, are we stopping here or?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's stop here with the meditation.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Devashishta. It was so useful.
Thank you. It was enjoyable all around. We can have a meditation.